You are now listening to the EU Startups Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the EU Startups Podcast. As always, I'm your host, David Senna-Garcia, the news editor here at EU Startups. Today, I chat with Rupa Poppet. She's the founder of the early-stage female-led VC Araya Ventures. Now, Araya was founded in 2022 in London, and it has an interesting focus of not only investing in diverse founders and diverse ideas, not only female-led, but also in training up a new generation of investors, whether it's angel investors, people interested in VC work, through their Araya Investment Academy and the recently announced Araya House. Through this, she also chatted to me about the impact AI has had on investment strategies, on the future of AI when it comes to European companies, as well as if there is an AI bubble at work and how she sees VCs adjusting to that. So I hope you're looking forward. But before, a quick message from our sponsor, Vanta.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority, but to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. And obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors, but they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one compliance solution, helping startups like yours get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. How? Vanta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. And the platform connects you with trusted VC SOs to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vanta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including many Y Combinator and Techstar startups, who trust Vanta. Simplify compliance and get $1,000 off at vanta.com/EU startups. That's vanta.com/EU startups.
Hello, Rupa, and welcome to the EU Startups Podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. I'm always interested in having these conversations with these entrepreneurs turned investors, because it really gives to such a great angle and a great look on both sides of the funding landscape, really. And I think our viewers will have a lot of interest into what you have to say.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Well, I thought we'd begin before we get into the actual interview. You could just present yourself, what you've done, who you represent, just to give our audience a quick rundown as to who you are.
Yeah, sure. That's great. So, thank you so much for having me. So I'm Rupa Poppet. I'm the founder and managing partner of Araya Ventures. We're an early stage venture capital firm backing incredible founders across like health tech, future of work, commerce, and fintech as well. So anything transforming the way we live and work. Over 65% of our investments are in AI startups right now, in AI application. And the other thing to mention is prior to that, I was an entrepreneur. I built several businesses, but the notable one was a B2B media company called Future Group, which was acquired in January 2019. By Pico, which is an Asian-based company. And prior to that, I was working in the corporate world. So I've kind of done all of the, I'd say all of my career innings have been kind of moving from working in corporate, being an entrepreneur, all the way through to now founding a venture capital firm.
Great. Well, I think an important thing to know right at the very beginning is the impact focus and gender focus Araya has in terms of the way it invests, in terms of the people that it looks to support. And building on that, I think the most important question, at least for me to begin with, is I wanted to hear about the moment when, so you say you sell Future Group, you sold it. And at what point did you think, well, now instead of being an entrepreneur, I want to go into investing? Because usually when there is that kind of change, it means that you've seen that there's a gap somewhere. You've seen that there's some kind of issue and some kind of a resolution that you can provide. And I'm curious to hear what that moment was for you.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, look, when I started, I left my job in 2012 and I was I guess maybe a little naive, but in a good way, about how quickly and how scalable I could build a company. My first attempt, this wasn't my first attempt as well. So I did go out in 2013 to fundraise for another startup that I'd been building, a tech startup. At the time, actually, I didn't end up raising the round, and the whole round fell apart. And that was a really good learning lesson for me in 2013. But I never thought it was because of structural issues in the ecosystem. I genuinely just thought maybe it was the business or my ability to go out and fundraise. So I definitely experienced it back then at the start of my journey. And I actually, the company that I built, I actually ended up building through EBITDA and profit. And so the growth had a different trajectory, but it still grew to 5 continents around the world before its exit. And I think that really, that business allowed me to meet kind of hundreds and thousands of startups across the world. And I kept seeing these tiny startups that were scaling at such pace through as our business was growing. And I thought, I wonder how one could get involved in, owning ownership in some of these companies, as well as supporting them on their journeys through our company. And that really led to the question in as early as, like, I would say 2016, like, how do you, and I started asking around. I found it to be quite an insider's club. I found it that you either had deal access or you didn't. And it was very much in groups of friends who would share deals amongst themselves. And so I didn't actually at the time find a natural entryway. I also didn't have a huge capital pot at that time. So I think that led me to post my exit when I then had time and capital to go and actually start deploying into some of these companies. And so one of the first things that I did after my exit, when I was ready to kind of, get active again, was start to build my own angel portfolio. And that portfolio, and really not just investing in the companies, but actually understanding that I truly had something to add back to those companies as well, which wasn't actually clear to me, surprisingly, on the way into it. But a founder would ask a question, I'd be able to give the answer from my own founder experience or my own journey, or because I had a network that I'd built over that time that I could make an introduction. And all of a sudden, I found various ways where I was adding value to these startups beyond just putting in the money. And I felt actually like I was this tiny little contributing part of their journeys. And that's what, for me, really got me excited about investing. At that point, if you'd asked me if I was going to run a fund or build a venture firm, I probably still would have. It really wasn't in, I always call myself this accidental VC. It was very accidental. I had a few people that asked me, when you're investing, can we invest in alongside you? It was very organic. Then they said, can we give you some money? And can you just invest it when you invest your own? And then that really led to me going out to raise Araya's first fund in 2024. So I'd say that both that part in between from exit to going out to raise was actually like a really important part. I was also the first external hire at Morgan Stanley Ventures during that time, and was working as an entrepreneur in residence with their portfolio companies. And again, just really understanding, like, what do I have that I can offer beyond just capital? Because capital is often, in some cases, the easier part to access. It's the other stuff that, those other support that you can have that I think is really important that comes with it.
Sure. And now we're looking, you were founded in 2022. So we're 4 years after the fact. And you just mentioned the different funds. We covered your 9.8 in 2024. We also covered a 22 million in 2025. So it's safe to say that you've grown and that the idea is working. And I'm kind of curious to hear about how you've progressed during that time. Because you're talking to me at the beginning, how much you brought in from your entrepreneur experience, but now you're positioning yourself as an investor and as the head of a VC fund and one that seems to be working. Has there been a philosophy or maybe a change in the way you've looked at the whole ecosystem?
Yeah, definitely. I think, first of all, being an investor is a real privileged seat to sit in the ecosystem. So I've been the founder with the idea, going around to networking events, trying to get someone to listen to what I'm going to build in the future. So having done the journey, I guess, part of this sitting in this seat, there's an element of privilege that comes with it, because you essentially get to distribute money out to the ideas that you want to back. At the same time, I think it's extremely important to be like humble and grounded during this time, because essentially really what we are like middlemen or middle women is the way I think about it. We have, you know, investors who are giving us money. Our job is to distribute it back out again and to add value to the founders as we do that. And then to add value to the investors by giving them returns at the end of that journey. And so ultimately we're this middle piece. And so we need to figure out how we can always add value to all of the parts of the ecosystem that we operate in. And that's, like I mentioned, the founders that we invest in. And I'm, you know, really proud of some of the stuff that the work that we've done with our companies that we're backed. We have actually, I keep forgetting the number. We have 25 investments right now, but we had 3 more pass investment committee last week. So we'll be at 28 very soon. But
I saw this morning we published an article where you're leading an investment round on First Concept was the company.
Oh, that's come out. Yeah.
It broke this morning and we covered it. Yeah, okay. I saw that.
Great. Okay, yeah, awesome. So that's another just phenomenal team. Really excited to back Connor and the team at First Concepts. But yeah, so we, you know, one part is like, what can we do to support and make their journeys better, easier, accelerated? Like, how do we 10x, like support 10x? And, you know, sometimes I say to the founders, like, we might have nothing to offer you. It might just be that you've got everything you need and we're just here and we've been privileged to sit on the journey with you. Otherwise, if there are things that we can do, here's a list of the sorts of things we do with our founders and can we support you in any of those ways? On the other side, you know, I'm extremely humbled by the fact that we have investors that, you know, really trust us to manage their money and manage their capital. And that comes with a sense of responsibility as well, right? Because ultimately they're parting their capital with us. And we know, I mean, traditional venture, not talking about the market we're in right now, because I do think we're in a shortened market cycle of opportunity with AI. But looking at traditional venture, you know, you're asking investors to wait 5-8 years to start seeing, even, you know, seeing results in a portfolio from where we invest. And so having these incredible like people that have, like, from the start, these early supporters that have, you know, backed it when it was just me in a presentation deck, I think is extremely humbling, but it also comes with that responsibility as well. And so essentially we're just here to provide value to, you know, to both those parties. And then at the same time, I feel, do whatever else we can in the ecosystem to help it rise and strong, like grow stronger and in that sense as well.
Sure. And then leaning into the gender, the gender thesis that Aurea kind of operates on. And we've reported on this many times, and I've seen you mention it too, this whole receiving less than 1% of VC funding. There was some line about pounds. Where is that? I have it somewhere. Yes. I mean, just an under allocation of funds, really, to diverse founders. And on that topic, I mean, how do you see the funding gap for women changing during this time? And this is, it's not a loaded question, but I think it is an important one to ask, is, do you feel Aurea Ventures has done its part to kind of change that and to make a noticeable difference?
Yeah, it's quite a loaded question. I was actually on a panel yesterday on this topic, so I always do get pulled into it. I think one of the things that I do think is, yes, the numbers haven't really changed. And in fact, everyone's saying they've got worse, as you know, in terms of what capital is actually going to female founded teams. I think there's a couple of things of progress that I have seen. We were just part of like a pre-seed round in Fit Collective, founded by Phoebe. And that was the largest pre-seed round of any female founder in the UK, which I thought was really awesome. Sifted, just, we're part of a list recently of Sifted where they announced like the 26 fully women-led VC firms in Europe, which is, you know, obviously growing even within the last few years as well. British Business Bank announced that there was more female angels for the first time last year than in a long piece of time. So all I would say is there's a lot of people doing a lot of work and there's a lot of progress happening. At the same time, we still are where we are and the numbers are the numbers, right? And so that begs to give, like, what are we not doing? And I don't know if you've seen the recent Rise report that Emmy Forst of Female Founders Rise has launched, but it's actually way worse than we even thought. Some of the survey responses of people's experiences with fundraising and... excuse me.
No problem.
So I think, you know, as we get through this topic, like it does get worse. Now, one of the things we always did from the beginning was Araya Super Angel Fund and Araya Global Fund, our two funds, don't have a gender mandate. So we don't say that we're going to invest in female-founded businesses only, or we're going to put a certain amount. But Super Angel Fund, which is the most deployed and where most of our investments are, we are 45% has at least one female founder in the founding team. And so obviously that's really so much more than the 1% that we hear about. And so the numbers really do stack up. And so I think it goes back to the same thing, is that we need to get more women in, or more diversity or more inclusion, however, whatever terminology you want to use, into capital allocation, whether that's at the fund of fund level, whether that's at the LP level, whether that's at the GP level. Because I didn't invest in these companies because they're female founded. I invested in them because they make great business opportunities and great investment opportunities for our portfolio. And I don't know if you've seen like recent Harvard studies as well, but they show that every time the female founders actually exit quicker, with half having spent half the money, so less dilution for investors, and actually produce more profitable returns as well for funds. So there's a lot of brilliant, I guess, studies coming out there, and we really need the numbers to continue to show that this is actually just a really good way to diversify your portfolio. It's not anything more than that. You know, we diversify in lots of different ways. Investors diversify through sectors, through types of investments, through check sizes and stages that they invest in, and investing in diversified, whether it's gender or other diversification, it's also, you know, really, really relevant to portfolio allocation. And so that's really like what we're quite proud of, is that we do that just because it made sense in our portfolio, not because it was a woman that was behind the company that we backed.
Sure. And then you've also got these initiatives that I've read about, the Araya Investment Academy. And then what I noticed this morning was House of Araya, which I hadn't seen until very recently. So maybe you could give us a little bit of rundown on that, because that caught me by surprise.
Yeah. So basically, it's very, very new. So I'm really, really done your research. So basically, as I think I've talked about before, is that part of this piece about we need more women at the capital allocation, or more diversity in general at the capital allocation level. And at the same time, in 2023, I started getting asked quite a lot, how does one get started in angel investing? It was all the questions that I was asking, like just a little bit, you know, years earlier. You get started, how do you decide about your portfolio? How do you decide which companies? What are you analyzing? How much time do you spend in the financial model? There's like 100 plus questions that I had that I was then being asked, and I would like offer my time, and I'd do like a coffee or a Zoom. And then I thought, actually, this needs to be a course. And so that's when Araya's Investment Academy launched. We have almost 400 graduates now who've graduated out of the academy, over 70% being women, who've now gone out to build their own portfolios, invest in their own companies. And I was actually catching up with one yesterday, and it's really phenomenal, like the portfolios that people have built, the successes they've seen since the course, and so on. And so that was really the beginning of like, how do we actually take people on the journey with us? How do we bring more capital allocators of diversity in at the earlier stages? And, you know, anyone is welcome. It's not like, oh, it's only for, you know, it's only for women. It started as that, but it really became so much bigger than that. And then about a year ago, I met Kavit Haria. And we started very early discussing what is the next evolution of what angel investors need and want and, you know, deserve if they're starting those journeys, or even if they're active angel investors. And so House of Araya is basically what we're launching next Monday. And right now we've just had a whole bunch of founding members who've joined, which is incredible to have that much support. But essentially it's taking our academy, turning it into even just modular frameworks. We even have now our AI investing module in there, which then has AI frameworks of how to analyze AI startups in particular. There's everything from portfolio construction tools to just phenomenal tools and support around constant education on the journey. At the same time, it also is a community platform. So everything sits in an online digital community that we bring together at quarterly dinners in kind of our core cities, and then also In person in an annual retreat every year. And so there's this kind of co-investment community, which a lot of, after people graduated from our courses, they were like, where do we go now? We want a community powered by this course. And we were like, well, we didn't have that. So now we have that. And then the final piece is that we'll get 8 to 10 or 8 to 12 deals a year that Araya has already put their money in. So it's already institutionally backed. It's something we've been tracking since our investment and from one of the funds. And then we will bring that over to on a deal by deal basis, where the members will be able to do their own due diligence, tap into ours as much as they want, but do their own due diligence, and then be able to make individual decisions on whether they want to invest or not in those deals. And so the idea is to bring like quality deals alongside education, really great frameworks, tools, and community as well. So House of Araya is that, and it is launching on Monday. So,
well, that's great. By the time this episode out, it will be old news, but
let's say Monday, 23rd of March then.
Okay. Yes, no, it will be old news, but it does sound very interesting, and it did catch my eye because it was just something I hadn't seen anywhere else, and I got to thinking what it might be about. And with this kind of all these initiatives to teach and to kind of train up a new generation, do you impart your own views as to what you look for in founders? Because I imagine that's also it's a very personal thing. And I imagine this must change person by person, but I imagine there must be some elements that you think are always quality and should always be kind of looked for in a founder.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good point. So we always say that this is one view, but we really want everyone to develop their own view. There's not one right way to be a successful angel investor. But the things that we do really try to impart is everything from how do you actually construct a portfolio? You know, most people stumble into angel investing with my cousin is launching a startup. They've left their job for it. They're really smart. They must know what they're doing. Let me put a check in, without thinking about what's the size of the total pot. How many years do you want to invest over? How many companies do you need in a power law rule to even have the chance to have one that becomes your returner of your portfolio? So even just things like that, that most people start investing without even thinking about, you know, I mean, I didn't. So let's just go a step back. Like when I started, I learned as I went. And I think this, the beauty of this is like, even I was looking through some of the frameworks that are launching in House of Araya that have come out of the Academy course. And I was like, I wish I had all of this just handed to me when I started. Like I literally, it was such a stumble and find and learn and, you know, kind of build it all together, that having all of that ready to go, I think is really wonderful. In answer to your question though, like, yes, there are traits that evolve. With the evolution of AI application startups and the market we're in right now, which actually I think is once in a generation opportunity for everyone to create wealth from AI over this next 3 to 5 year period. I think that with that comes also, how do you, what do you overweight in versus what you used to look at before in a traditional B2B SaaS business? So we try and differentiate between the before and today and what still stands true. And then what do we overweight in? We give sample questions. We give like scoring frameworks specifically for AI startups. What question, sample question kits and all of these sorts of things. And so the deal evaluation checklist. So it's really like the purpose of all of it is to really help give as much as possible. But at the end of the day, investing in early stage, as I'm sure you'll know, is like science and art. And part of that is intuition, your gut instinct, your own views on a specific market and an opportunity. And that, I think, is one of the things that I think each individual brings. And I'll just give one example. We had an Academy course, and this is why I think House of Araya will be so powerful, the way that the community invests, because we have live case studies on our Academy courses where we put these frameworks into real life examples where the startups pitch and from our portfolios, and then they get to do a real life due diligence kind of case study. And in one of them, it was a health startup, and we had like a politician in the room. We had a McKinsey consultant. We had an entrepreneur a doctor and a TikTok creator amongst the whole classroom. Mm. And if you can imagine a group due diligence on a women's health startup with all of these diverse backgrounds, you had like the politician asking, how do we get this out to the masses? You had McKinsey's consultant talking about go-to-market strategy, the entrepreneur looking at the spend and going, you know, how are you going to hire these people with this spend? You have a doctor talking about efficacy of clinical trials and trying to get into the details of that. And then you had the TikTok creator asking about customer acquisition costs, you know, what sort of owned media brand are you going to build real trust around your product? And how are you thinking about that? So all of a sudden, by bringing this group of, and so when we talk about diversity, it's not diversity of just gender, it's diversity of backgrounds, experiences. It makes a due diligence process so much richer because, you know, which is essentially what we do in VC as well. Like, you know, we're looking at a health data life sciences business right now. We bring in our venture partner who's, you know, at a big pharma company who knows exactly about that sector. We bring in, you know, one of our health venture partners. We bring in our, in our team, our expert in health tech is leading that deal. So it's exactly what we do is we bring in all the people around us that we need. In the same way in angel investing, the value you can do in your DD can compound by the people that you're investing with and that crowd that you bring together. And I think that's what I think is so powerful and exciting about bringing a community together to do angel investing in that way.
And you mentioned AI as an important focus point now of how you're approaching investment. I think it's a good opportunity to kind of shift into that line of questioning because I know it's an important part of what you focus on. And I know it's an interesting subject, I think, for anybody listening. And I wanted to start with, because I've seen that you've talked about your want to see the UK as a European AI hub and the potential that it has in that ecosystem to become one. And that kind of leads me down the line of, and I'm not to get political, but it does lead me down the line of the EU as its own entity is developing its own AI push with its own data center capacity. And the UK is also doing that on a separate level. So then how do you see those two kind of coinciding and landing in the UK as this European AI hub? And what kind of ecosystem can founders build there if they're not from the UK?
Yeah, great question. So I just want to caveat that we just invested in a phenomenal German AI company. Which I'm hoping to announce soon. We're also going to IC for two other European companies tomorrow for our global fund. So I actually think that there's multiple hubs of talent across UK plus Europe for this space. I'm also going to be at Station F like next month, like in Paris. Like I think there's just phenomenal opportunities across the ecosystem. So I think that you don't have to be in London to build in this space. The area where we invest, where I think, you know, is one of the most exciting areas right now and is the AI application. So like the overlay, which sits above, you know, the models and so on. And they're normally like either vertical solutions or a very specific pain point problems that are being solved by these applications, but they embed quite deeply into the workflow of that, you know, problem set, whether it's in health, whether it's in the future of work kind of sectors. Mm. And what we've seen over the last, I would say like over 12 to 18 months is that in Europe, Europe and UK, the UK has done almost 50% of the money raised in AI has been in the UK, specifically London market. And so when I say that London is a really exciting hub, we do have a huge portfolio here. And we continue to be amazed and impressed by the quality of teams that are coming to build in this moment. Because I think, you know, we backed a founder at the end of last year who had an earnout for his previous company, and he gave up the earnout of I think it was like 3-year lock-in to be able to just go build again because he thinks he can build something way bigger than what his earnout was going to be because of the moment we're in right now. And I think that pretty much sums up, like, you know, the teams and the people coming to build right now. And that's not just in London, that's everywhere, but London right now is taking a much larger share of the funding that's coming in. And that's really where I think London is one of very, very many key hubs. I also think that in this next phase, because competition. You know, traditionally you build a SaaS business, the country you're in is where you have to get product market fit before you go scale elsewhere. Typically, that, you know, that whole model is turned on its head now, because you can launch from your bedroom anywhere in the world, a startup that can go and support and serve customers anywhere in the world. And so the whole model itself has shifted completely. And I think that is, you know, super powerful in itself, but tells you a lot about, it matters less where you build from, but it doesn't matter where you have funding support from, where you have scalability support from, whether that's through talent, customer, all of these sorts of things, because actually speed is one of the biggest factors leading to success more than ever before now. And so, you know, and that's on multiple levels. That's your iterative feedback loop from commercial to product. As you iterate your product, that speed of getting to market, speed of shipping new features, speed of always showing your customers that you continue to earn the right to be their provider, because switching costs are also lower than ever before. And so opportunity really comes from, you know, operating at speed. And that's how we've been able to see firms like Lovable and 11 Labs come, you know, within years, come into these incredible valuations. And I think there's going to be many more of them. But I also think there's going to be many more $100 million plus exits without multiple rounds of dilution with very small teams. And we're already seeing approaches in our portfolio. It's not like years off, it's happening already, because if you think about it, the M&A buyer group of this particular moment is expanded and way bigger than it ever was before. I think of it as like health providers, consulting firms, IT services businesses, enterprise businesses, any incumbent business who's thinking, how will AI disrupt my business, will be at some stage needing to look at their balance sheet and thinking about, what do I need to acquire in to still be present in the next iteration. And so I think that has lent to this incredible like M&A opportunity, but this incredible ability to like look at every single pain point again that's ever been solved for or built for, because there's probably another solution for it now that is an AI native company solving for it.
So it seems to me that you're all in on the AI bet. And you know, you're not alone. Obviously, we've been tracking other VCs who are all kind of just, you know, releasing vehicles that are specifically AI focused, from, you know, sub 10 million to over 120. So there's a whole range of interest in what you're talking about right now. Now, that does make me think about, and I think everybody's worrying about this, because, well, I mean, if I were to think up a quick coverage number in my head, I'd say around 60% of all the companies we cover here are AI based. And that's been an explosion in the past couple of years, of where it was a few to now the majority already are. But there has to be maybe an underlying worry there of things like the AI bubble, things that this could just kind of go all explode all over us. And all of a sudden, these companies that have these ginormous valuations can't really give back their worth and can't really sell what they're trying to do. So I'm wondering if there is any kind of a dialogue on that from where you're sitting. And this could really pull into any predictions you might have for where the AI ecosystem will be 5 years from now.
Yeah, great question. I mean, 5 years is, we're working with, shorter timeframes, but no, 5 years is great. So look, I absolutely understand that when people are looking in, they're thinking, what the hell is going on? Like every day there's like numerous AI startups being funded. At the same time, I would step back and just look at what has actually happened. So what actually happened is, if you think about every problem statement we've ever solved for in the last how many ever decades of building startups, there are multiple problem statements that now can be solved with AI native businesses and AI applications. So for example, one of the businesses, Anchor, that we backed last year, it's a $1.2 trillion loss faced by that industry in payments onboarding annually that it's solving for. Now, you know, it's in regulatory compliance. It's not necessarily the sexiest industry or the sexiest problem statement, but it is a serious problem statement that needs solving, and someone's going to go build and solve for that. And so there, you know, our job is, as investors, is to figure out who we believe is the best team with the best skill set to go in and solve that problem. At the same time, we've invested in this incredible company, which I mentioned at the beginning, actually, because it's the largest pre-seed round in the UK for a female founder, called Fit Collective. And what they're doing, again, is like, there's always been startups solving for returns being, you know, like in the fashion industry, returns are over 50% of items ordered online are returned. And actually, in some countries, it goes up to 70%. Now, that's an incredible problem that these businesses have that continues to compound as they bring more SKUs, more products, more lines. It hasn't got any better over there. I've seen so many startups over the last 10 years that have been trying to solve this thing. Now, what Fit Collective does, and we spent a really long time looking at this industry because we realized that's a huge problem statement. Now, how are people going to solve it? And what she essentially has done is taking the returns data of why people are returning those items and then training that into the product merchandising stage before the product merchandising orders even go out to the factories for production. And so, you know, starting to understand, like, is that because of the material? Is that because that particular factory produces things slightly smaller every time? Is that what can that return data continue to do? And you can imagine as you embed into a retailer's life cycle of products, that data set and that whole thing compounds and becomes more and more powerful. So that business is not a bubble business. It's solving like all of us, they're solving real pain points that just couldn't be solved before because it wasn't possible in the same way, 3 to 5 years ago in the way it is now. And they're able to integrate in hours into retailers' tech stacks. So, and that's one of like every example in our portfolio is they are big problem statements that need to be solved, that have a real solution that, you know, needs that is, we believe is the right solution. And then we believe is the right team building for that. And we look for very specific things in our AI application startups. So the speed I mentioned, like both velocity of speed within the feedback loop, but also and how, what's signal, what's noise. And number two, how they think about product market fit, because once upon a time you reach product market fit and you had it forever, it was a given and you just put more money into the funnel and you just scaled. And now you have to re-earn product market fit often as much as every 3 months. So it's no longer a given. So how do they think about that? What do they see as signal versus noise when they're looking at what's feeding their decision-making process? And in 2026, all of that is irrelevant if you don't have a unique distribution channel and a brand to back it up. So something that is trusted, something that is unique to you, something that compounds with value, even as more a competitor may come out with something similar 3 months later, what is it that's powerful? And then the other piece is what else, what other value is compounding? And I gave you the Fit Collective example. As the more that gets used by that retailer and other retailers, when you start to map out, truly understand, is it the factory? Is it the material? What is it, the, a misstep in the design? What is it that is causing that huge pain point? And, you know, we always define our pain points by time or money. And so, you know, when you're able to show with one retailer that one solving one product merchandising issue saved £500,000, you can imagine the retailer's thinking, whoa, let me multiply that by all my SKUs and across the whole year. Like, that is a huge, you know, that impacts a bottom line in a significant way in margins. And so that is going to move the needle. And so we're looking at what is moving the needle, what is compounding with value. Is it the data as it continues? Is it the learning loops? What is it? Is it the way users collaborate within the product, or their network effects within the product that compound with time or with value or with usage? And then the piece I said, which I think is like the bit I just keep honing in on, is distribution and brand is what 2026 and beyond is all about. And so seeing what's unique about that, we just actually went to IC last week with a startup that even turned it on the head for me of what I even could imagine unique distribution to be. And I can't talk about the company yet because we haven't closed, but this whole thing is developing. But unique distribution, distribution as a moat is like one of, you know, the most important things at the moment. So I'd say that all of the things we still look at are the same. Also, when we value stuff, we're at the early stages. It's very disciplined. It's not like the hype numbers that you hear about in the markets at the later stages. And so I would say that where we invest and where we kind of, it's still priced in the same disciplined way. Like, how much is the founder diluting? Mm-hmm. What should be the pre-money valuation? Or, you know, how much, you know, and that's determined by a lead investor or, you know, whoever, you know, a mixture of investors with the founders as well as a collaborative effort. So, you know, and I think founders also just in general are realizing more and more that hype valuations, especially in the early stages, can hinder your progress than benefit it. So it's not a given that if you raise your pre-seed or your seed at like an exponential price, that that's going to do anything to help you, because you then have to catch up to meet that valuation in your next round. So I think, yes, there are those hype valuations, but it's definitely not where, it's not how we invest. We still keep the same, you know, plans of ownership targets. And occasionally we'll go a little bit outside of our target ownership for something really special. But, you know, majority of the time, that's really where we invest within our kind of target ownership.
Well, I want to thank you for all these questions. I'm gonna leave you with one final one, and then I'll let you get back to your day here. That I think kind of an ending note here, I think it's nice to think about the legacy that you want to leave behind with Araya, and that because you have a lot of initiatives, so you're focused on much more than just investing. You're focused on training up a new generation. So I just want to hear a little about where, if you know, if you're looking forward and Araya is no more or it's moved on, what would be the legacy that you'd look for it to leave behind?
Yeah, so I think it goes back to the value piece we talked about at the beginning. Is like, what value have we given to all of the participants in our Araya ecosystem, whether it's the investors that have trusted us with their capital to go and deploy it, whether it's the founders that have entrusted us. You know, we quite a lot of the rounds we've got into are like, you know, 2-3x oversubscribed sometimes, and we have to earn the right to be part of their journeys. And there's always this like thing that it's like, you know, there's a misbalance between founders asking for money and funds having the capital. But actually, I see it as like a two-way exchange. You know, we're having the privilege to go on that journey with them as well. And that comes with a sense of responsibility if they want anything, you know, additional support alongside that. And at the same time, you know, it's for founders to choose the right partners for them for their journey. And, you know, we have to earn the right to be that. And so I think that is, you know, very much a key part of our proposition and key part of what we want to be and care about. And I think on the other side is, as our ecosystem grows and our impact grows, whether that's getting more fund managers funded as well, because this all goes back to capital allocation. So whether it's getting more fund managers funded, whether it's we're getting more angels into the ecosystem that otherwise thought, like me at the beginning, how do I get into this? Or this isn't for me because I didn't come from a traditional investing background. And so as whatever those things are, it will all be about what value have we added back. The ultimate goal of Araya is to have Araya Foundation. So as we actually start getting profits back from exits as well, is that that will fund through. And it's obviously very early days, but we're already starting to shape what we want that to look and feel like. And that will then be kind of the final piece as well of like, you know, repurposing the capital back out again into things that really matter in the world. And so I guess it, yeah, just value. If we've made a difference in whether it's the founder's journey in some shape or form, or, you know, the way that they think or the way that they run their businesses, you know, like we have masterclasses every 2 weeks, and the next one is on unconscious decisions and decisions you make when you're under pressure and stress that it might be coming from your subconscious. So we try and help founders from thinking about how they operate in the world, from mental health all the way through to, yes, go to market strategies with the best experts and, you know, how to prepare for your Series A. So we do all the traditional stuff, but we also want to make sure that we're supporting in maybe ways that are, you know, others aren't. And then on the other side is, yeah, delivering return to our investors. So both A, returns, but B, that they've made a difference because of their capital has helped us do what we've done on the other side. And yeah, the more angels, the more people we can bring into the ecosystem that thought it didn't look like it was for them, it would just be, it's just a bonus. And even more so at this moment, as I said, with AI, you know, this AI is going to reorganize society in ways that, you know, and sorry, we never got to the 5-year prediction, but it is going to be a massive reorganization. And you know, whoever can benefit from the, you know, for what's happening right now, and by being involved in some, you know, in any of those participants, angel, LP, founder, like we would love to be part of that journey with them as well.
Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing many more news from Araya in the future to come. We're always paying attention here to you startups, so we'll definitely be supportive of it going forward. And I want to thank you, Rupa, for coming onto the show. It's been a pleasure. Wish we could stay longer, but I promise your comms people 30 minutes. I'm gonna try and stick to it.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much for a great
It's been our pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.